I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The Bourne Identity, Memento, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Amnesia is a Hollywood staple. Even the true stories often seem fantastical. Just last month, an Ontario man named Edgar LaTulip recovered his memory after 30 years. He'd been missing and presumed dead, although he was living 80 miles from home. Acute memory loss fascinates us, probably because in many ways we are our memories. What triggers amnesia? What happens to your sense of self when your memory is gone? What can amnesia teach us about memory? Dr. Jason Brandt, a neuropsychologist at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine who specializes in memory and memory disorders, joins us in studio to explore these issues and take your questions. Memory on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad that you have joined us today. Today we're talking about memory, how our memory works and what happens when it doesn't, amnesia. In the most profound cases of amnesia, people lose all sense of identity. Take the case of Clive Waring. Waring was an accomplished British musicologist who was struck with profound amnesia in 1985 after a virus attacked his central nervous system. He remembers very little of his past and retains new memories for less than 30 seconds. Here's a clip from a BBC documentary about Clive Waring. He's trying to explain to his wife what his condition is like.
I've nothing to say about it. It's just like death. No thoughts of any kind, no dreams, no difference between day and night, no sight, no sound, no taste, no touch, no smell, exactly like death. No difference between day and night. No thoughts, nothing. No dreams, nothing at all. Any question you have, just answer, I don't know. There's nothing to say. No dreams, no sight, no sound, no taste, no touch, no smell, nothing at all, no thoughts, nothing.
You can hear how frustrated he is. It seems like a sad life. Yet Clive Waring has retained his ability to play the piano and even conduct a choir. Cases like his have helped scientists understand where and how memories are stored in the brain. That's the rare kind of amnesia. Other forms are much more common. Alzheimer's patients experience amnesia, for example. They, too, are advancing our understanding of memory. Dr. Jason Brandt, a neuropsychologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine who studies patients with amnesia and other memory disorders, is here in studio to help us explore what we've learned about memory from patients with memory disorders. Dr. Brandt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila.
So let's start with the case of Clive Waring. How is it that he can remember to play music, and yet he has no recollection of his children?
Right. Well, one of the things that the study of amnesic patients has taught us is that there are different memory systems in the brain. The system that is most often affected in people who have the amnestic syndrome is a system for what we call episodic memory. This is remembering the events of our lives, things that are specific to a time and a place and a context. Learning to play or remembering how to play the piano or musical instrument, remembering various procedures, remembering skills, is a different kind of memory and is based in a different memory circuitry.
A different location, a different circuit.
The episodic memory system is very dependent on a structure called the hippocampus, which is tucked within the temporal lobes of the brain. However, procedural memory, such as remembering how to play the piano, or eat with a knife and fork, or tie your shoes, or ride a bike, is based in a different set of memory structures, primarily the basal ganglia, a set of structures in the forebrain. So memory is not one thing. It's really a composite of different kinds of abilities and different kinds of skills.
But Clive Waring does remember his wife, or at least he's very keen for her to visit. But he doesn't seem to remember his children or their names. What does that tell us about circuitry in the brain?
Well, we know that longer lasting memories or earlier established memories are often retained longer. That's something that we routinely see in people who have a kind of retrograde amnesia. Memory for the distant past is retained better than memory for the recent past. So he's known his wife for a long time. They have much more of a history together. The memory of her, or the strength of the engram of his wife, is stronger, is more robust, whereas his children are more recent additions to his life, presumably, and might have weaker engrams associated with them.
Well, walk us through the different types of amnesia.
Well, there are sort of two fundamental types of amnesia. One is the organic amnestic. Let me back up and saying that we really can talk about amnesia as a symptom and as a syndrome. And I think that's an important distinction. So amnesia as a symptom occurs in lots of conditions like Alzheimer's disease, the dementias. It occurs in delirium or confusional states. And it simply means a severe inability to learn or remember new things due to brain dysfunction. Amnesia as a syndrome means that the amnesia is the only thing that's wrong with the person. That is, it's an isolated deficit. In Alzheimer's disease, we have amnesia, but we also have language problems. We have problems with praxis or skilled movements. We have a variety of disorders in Alzheimer's disease. That's why we call it a dementia rather than an amnesia. Amnesia is an isolated impairment in the ability to learn and remember new information. And that's the amnestic syndrome. These patients retain their intellect. They can be extremely bright and gifted. I had a patient for many years that I followed who had an IQ of 132. He was a very distinguished attorney in Baltimore, had argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. And yet he was unable to learn my name. I followed him for 9 years, never knew who I was. And he had fundamentally no information storage or retention past about 5 minutes.
What happened with him? I mean, where did that...
So he had an amnestic syndrome that was due to a particular disorder that we called Korsakoff syndrome. So the amnestic syndrome has many different etiologies or many different causes. You brought up the fact that Clive Waring has an amnesia due to a viral infection of his brain. My patient, who I just mentioned, had Korsakoff syndrome, which is damage to the brain caused by a deficiency of thiamine in the diet, and it's almost always seen in severe alcoholic patients. So this gentleman was a very, very heavy alcohol abuser. Many patients who drink extensively don't eat a proper diet, and the lack of thiamine in the diet causes hemorrhagic lesions in parts of the brain that cause his amnestic syndrome.
So let me make sure I'm following this. It was ultimately that diet deficiency created a physical damage in his brain.
Correct.
So it wasn't the diet deficiency directly, which could then be corrected, presumably. It was a diet deficiency that damaged a structure in his brain.
That's correct. So when we talk about the amnestic syndrome, all of these conditions are caused by brain damage. They're caused by damage to particular areas within the brain. Korsakoff syndrome usually follows a confusional state or a delirium that we see in heavy alcohol abusers. We call it the Wernicke state, or the Wernicke encephalopathy is the fancy name for it. And when patients are in that state after about a very heavy drinking, they're at risk of death. Many patients are brought to the emergency room. And one of the first things that happens when they're in the emergency room is they get an injection of thiamine. And in fact, if an alcohol abuser comes into the ER of a hospital, one of the first things that is done is that they're given thiamine to prevent the creation of these hemorrhages in parts of the brain that can give them this devastating syndrome.
So is it possible to reverse that?
No. Korsakoff's amnesia is a relatively permanent condition. There are some patients who get a little bit better over time, but for the most part, it's a permanent disorder.
That is Dr. Jason Brandt here on Midday on WIPR. He is a neuropsychologist at Johns Hopkins, a memory expert. If you know someone with amnesia, perhaps related to Alzheimer's, have you been surprised by which memories they hold on to and which ones they don't? You can join this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You have been talking in the last couple of minutes about memories, what I think of memories going forward. In other words, he could meet you and not remember you the next time or even a few minutes later. You didn't mention, what about his past memories? And do those two stashes of memory live differently and show up differently in your work?
They do, absolutely. In most cases of the organic neurologic amnestic syndrome, the most severe impairment is for new learning and memory. The ability to establish new memories going forward is the thing that's most impaired. And there's more mild impairment for the past, memory for the past. And that's the typical scenario in the organic amnestic syndrome. However, there's another type of amnesia that your listeners might be more familiar with, which is psychogenic amnesia, what I sometimes call soap opera amnesia, because you'll see a case of it in most soap operas eventually. And it makes for excellent movies and television, and it can be very dramatic. And these are cases where there is no evidence of brain damage per se, no evidence of brain dysfunction, but the person develops a memory loss primarily of their past without an impairment in the ability to learn and remember new things. So a patient with what we call psychogenic amnesia or functional or amnesia, what we used to call hysterical amnesia, loses the ability to remember their own personal past, their own autobiography, but often do quite well on our tests of new learning and memory. In these patients, there really is no evidence of brain dysfunction per se. The etiology or the presumed origin is presumably some stressful or emotionally traumatic life event that has caused this lack of memory.
And those are the cases where we often hear that somebody's regained their memory.
That's right. That's right. Those are the patients where a traumatic event will trigger it. It will usually come on suddenly. The person often loses their identity, which is something that we don't see in the organic, in the neurologic amnestic syndrome. Our patients with neurologic amnesia know their names, know who they are. But patients with the psychogenic amnesia sometimes lose their personal identity.
So when we talked about Clive Waring, he lost both, right?
So he has a severe anterograde amnesia, that is, inability to learn new information, as well as substantial retrograde amnesia, loss of his past. And he's a striking case because he has very severe impairments in both domains.
How common is that?
Well, it's relatively rarer. The patients who have encephalitis or a viral infection of the brain, which typically attacks the hippocampus on both sides, that critical memory structure, they usually have very severe impairment in new learning ability and varying degrees of retrograde amnesia, varying degrees of memory impairment for the past. The variability among patients is probably due to the severity of the disease, what other areas of the brain are affected, and so on.
That is Dr. Jason Brandt here on Midday on WYPR. He's a neuropsychologist and memory expert. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with him and take your calls. Do you find that certain kinds of memories stick with you better than others? Why do you think that is? Join the conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we're talking about a fascinating subject, amnesia, and what we've learned about memory from people who suffer from memory disorders. My guest is Dr. Jason Brandt, a professor of psychiatry and neurology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. So tell me about the research. What is it that what have we learned from people who are struggling with the different kinds of amnesia that you've described?
Well, we've learned an awful lot. Our study of amnesic patients in the modern era really goes back to a very famous case who goes by the initials HM. He was really the first patient studied in a systematic way who had an amnestic syndrome due to a surgical lesion. HM was a young man who had severe epileptic seizures, and in 1953, the surgeon, in an effort to cure him, his disorder was unresponsive to the medications that were then available, the temporal lobes of both sides of his brain were removed, including the hippocampus. And the surgery was effective in ameliorating his seizure disorder, but he was left with a very, very severe and dense amnestic syndrome. And HM was studied from the 1950s, really up until his death in 2008. He donated his brain for research upon his death, and he's still being studied. His brain has been subjected to a variety of neuropathological studies. So we're able to form associations between the kinds of deficits that he displayed during life and his particular neuropathology. And one of the things that the study of HM taught us, and again, this is probably the most famous patient in the history of neuroscience and certainly the most studied, is that there are a variety of forms of memory. And so procedural memory would be retained. His ability to do puzzles and solve puzzles would show, for example, that he retained what he had done before. Each time he did a motor task, solving a motor puzzle or a maze or something like that, his time would get faster. He'd do it better
over time. So he could learn. He could not only retain a memory, but actually build skill.
He could build skills, but he didn't retain the memory. That is, if you ask him, Henry, we now know his name is Henry Mullison, he said, Henry, have you ever done this before? He said, no, I don't know what to do. And so he has
no... And then he would do it very well.
And then he would do it very well. So he would have no explicit recollection of ever having done it before, and yet he knows how to do it. So we see a real dissociation between what we call episodic memory, or memory for an event, or memory for an experience, and procedural memory, which is knowing how to do something, or how to do something, not what it is.
And so that led researchers to figure out that procedural memory is someplace else in the brain.
Is based in a different part of the brain. One of the areas that we think are involved is the basal ganglia. And I've been involved in some studies of patients with basal ganglia disorders, in particular Huntington's disease, which is a relatively rare genetic disorder that affects the basal ganglia. And patients with Huntington's disease have just the opposite problem. They have much more severe problems with procedural memory, with getting better at things with practice or over time, and their episodic memory, or their memory for experiences, is relatively milder. So we see what we call a double dissociation, that the hippocampal memory system is important for episodic memory, and the basal ganglia are more important for procedural memory.
Well, one of the things that I think I know about Huntington's disease is that they are looking for genetic links, and I think actually have started to find genetic links. So this whole conversation that we're having about how memory works, amnesia, is this different in different people according to their genes?
Well, yes. I mean, in Huntington's disease, the gene has been identified. It was identified in 1993. At Johns Hopkins, we started the first program in the country of genetic testing for Huntington's disease in people who are at risk by virtue of having a parent with it. And we know that there's a particular gene involved in Huntington's disease that affects the development and the deterioration of the basal ganglia. So it's not a gene that's important in memory per se, but a gene that's responsible for the syndrome. That being said, we know that memory in normal people without brain disease is under some degree of genetic control, and probably a fair amount of our memory skills that vary from person to person are heritable, that is, have a genetic component.
One of the things that confuses me about the Henry Mollison case that you were describing, all I know about it is a review that I read in The New Yorker of the book that the doctor who was most involved in his care wrote about him. Suzanne Corkin, and I'm not quickly finding the name of the book, but I will. But in the description, the summary in The New Yorker's review, it sounded like this surgery kind of went at quite a few pieces of his brain. So much that when it seems to me, it's not obvious to me how you scientists can know, oh, this was the temporal lobe, this was this structure, because there were several structures removed from his brain.
Well, in fact, temporal lobectomy is still a procedure that's used in the treatment of epilepsy. In fact, it's a commonly used treatment. It's a very effective treatment. It's a very good treatment.
Does it always zap the memory?
Well, the issue was that in HM, it was done bilaterally. It was done on both sides of the brain, and we never do a bilateral temporal lobe resection anymore. So it was known from animal research and from a variety of other studies that the temporal lobes and the hippocampus were important in memory. But moreover, that was the area that was giving rise to seizures. There was no indication that doing a bilateral temporal lobe resection would create an amnestic syndrome. There had certainly been patients operated on with unilateral, one-sided operations, and they did quite well. Since HM had epileptic activity emanating from both temporal lobes, it was, I think, a reasonable decision of his medical team to remove the areas of epileptic tissue. We just didn't know at that time that it would create an amnestic syndrome, and obviously we don't do that procedure anymore.
Okay, so are you telling me then that memory, the ability to form new memories, the ability to learn in that sense, is located in one of the other sides, we don't know which? Or that if it's located in both places, if you remove one, the other can compensate?
It's more likely the latter. We know that the two temporal lobes and the two hippocampi do slightly different things. Most right-handed people have their language skills in the left side of their brain. And their left temporal lobe, their left hippocampus, is very concerned with verbal memory. So memory for stories, memory for text that they read, memory for word lists, remembering a grocery list, for example, differentially depends on the activity of the left hippocampus. The right hippocampus is involved in spatial memory, where something is. Where did I park my car in the parking garage?
I must be so deficient in that part of my brain.
Where did I put my keys? So spatial memory, remembering things that can't be put into words, such as faces. Think about all the thousands of people that you can recognize by their face, and yet you can't put that into words. If you try to describe someone's face to another person, it's well nigh impossible. We don't have the words for that.
CBS 60 Minutes just did a piece, or re-aired a piece about face blindness, people who just don't pick up those details. Mm-hmm. I'm Sheila Cast. This is Midday on WIPR, and we're talking with Dr. Jason Brandt, a neuropsychologist at Johns Hopkins. We're talking about memory and what we've learned about the brain from people with memory disorders. Do you worry about losing your memory? Join our conversation by calling 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org.
Sheila, I thought you asked me if I worry about losing my
memory. Maybe we should have that conversation later, but right now let's talk to Blima, who is calling us from Owings Mills. Blima, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Fascinating topic. I'm 69, and I have lived through immigration about 4 years ago or so. I have terrible memory loss of events and years in my past. Meanwhile, as an adult, I learned two new languages. I had worked for a Fortune 500 company very successfully for many years. And so my question is there any way that I can retrieve those old memories? When I talk to my family, they mention an event. Slowly, somehow, I think it's there, and I remember parts of it. And when I look at pictures, I also remember where it was taken and how. But in a conversation, I have years that I have no idea what I did, what happened. And I know I went to school, but I don't remember names of any of my classmates, even when I graduated high school. So is there any way that I can retrieve those memories?
Blima, it's an interesting question you pose. Dr.
Well,
Brandt?
Blima, those must have been wild years for you. I think that's that's why there's little recollection of them. So there are a couple of ways to answer that. One is how do you bring them back? And I was going to recommend things like looking at photo albums and talking with family and so forth. And it might be that those are items or periods of time that you haven't depended on, you haven't talked about, you haven't thought about for a long time. I think most people have had the experience, especially in this era of Facebook and social networking, of being reconnected with a person from your past, someone that you might not have thought about for years and years, and you hear the name or you get a friend request from somebody and you say, oh my God, I haven't thought about that person in 30 years. And then memories start flooding back and they're often very emotional memories. I know I've had that experience of having a connection with somebody and I haven't thought about that in a long time. And there's often a feeling of nostalgia that comes with it. We tend to remember things that are important to us, that are meaningful to us. The events that you say that you can't remember, they might have not been stored adequately. You know, one of the ways that we remember things well is we have to process them and encode them and store them adequately. And we experience thousands of things every day that we never make memories of because they're just not important to us. And so one of the reasons why we don't recall things is that we never made a good memory of it in the first place. And I think that's a natural and important thing to do because our brain has limited capacity. Our brains are not like a movie camera or a video camera that creates a perfect storage of everything that we see. It's selective. We choose the things from our experiences that we think are going to be important and create memories of them.
But Blima has left us, so I cannot ask her whether, I mean, I got the impression as she was posing her question to you that she cared about her high school memories. But so I don't think I don't know whether it was a matter of just speeding through life and willy-nilly not paying attention. But even if we are taking time, I mean, most of us don't say, very seldom, occasionally I will say to myself, I want to hold this in memory. I want to remember this perfect moment with this sunset or something. Mostly, memory, making memories, storing them, however we do that, is not something we consciously direct ourselves to do.
Right. Correct. And we we are able to our brains are able to select from our varied experiences the things that are critical for us at a given point in time. Usually things that are emotionally charged or emotionally important or emotionally salient tend to be better encoded and better stored. We know that the hippocampus, that memory structure that I talked about before, is also part of a system called the limbic system of the brain that's very important in emotions. Right on top of the hippocampus, I'm gesturing yes. here as if your audience can see what I'm
yes.
doing.
His one hand is curved around the other, and that is supposed to be
the amygdala sitting right on top of the hippocampus. And the amygdala is very critical for emotions, emotional memory. And so things that are emotional are imbued with greater significance and cause greater stronger engrams to be made. Again, we don't think about it at the time, but emotionally important things or salient things stand out in our memories.
Are there patterns, habits that we're unconsciously undermining our ability to hold on to memories? I mean, for example, if you're not sleeping enough, is that going to impair your ability to make a memory that you can call up again?
Sure. I think it's well established that sleep is important for the creation of memories. RNA is synthesized during sleep, and RNA synthesis is critical for creation of memories. So yes, sleep is very important for what we call consolidating memories. We also are concerned about things like alcohol and other medications that people take. There's a lot of evidence that memory formation can be what we call state dependent, that if you learn something in a state of intoxication, even if it's sort of subclinical intoxication, you won't remember it as well when you're not intoxicated.
George is calling us. I think he wants to pick up on you, when we were talking about how the epilepsy surgery was done. George from Towson, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Your question?
I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, we hear you. Your question?
About 10 years ago, I had ECT. It was originally bilateral, and
ECT, electroconvulsive therapy?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
It was originally bilateral. I complained about memory loss at the time. It was switched to unilateral. Like I said, it's about 10 years ago, and now I'm having pretty serious memory problems. Is there a link between the lobectomy and ECT in this kind of situation?
George, thanks for the question.
Well, ECT, that's a very good question. ECT is a treatment for usually severe refractory major depressive disorder, and it tends to be a successful, an effective treatment. And one of its few downsides is that it causes some mild memory impairment. Typically, people have severe dense amnesia for the treatment itself. So patients don't remember going into the ECT treatment room, and they tend to be a little bit confused afterwards. But then memory comes back to normal, and the person's consciousness reverts to normal. But over a series of treatments, a person can develop some memory loss. This tends to be of the episodic variety. People have difficulties learning and retaining new episodic information. It tends to be relatively mild and tends to go away over time. So that years after ECT, we don't expect to see significant memory difficulties.
When George says he's starting to have new memory difficulties 10 years later, that may not be connected?
It may not be connected. It may be, we know that depression in and of itself has memory loss associated with it. So we know that patients, when they are depressed, have severe impairments in learning new information if they're extremely depressed. It could be other things that are happening. If I were George, I would certainly discuss it with my healthcare providers and maybe have that formally evaluated.
Okay.
George also brought up the difference between a bilateral ECT and unilateral ECT. We used to do ECT over both sides of the brain, but now more often we're doing it over just the right side so as not to cause a verbal memory problem.
We need to take another break here. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about memory and memory disorders with Dr. Jason Brandt, professor of neurology and psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Are you someone with a particularly good memory? How do you do it? Do you have tricks for remembering things? Join our conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Jason Brandt, a neuropsychologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. Brandt specializes in memory and memory disorders. Do you think our memories make us who we are? Join our conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us 410-662-8780. So your work includes Alzheimer's. You said that amnesia is just sort of one symptom of Alzheimer's, but it's part of what you study. What kind of questions are you trying to answer about Alzheimer's?
Well, Alzheimer's, as you know, is a prevalent condition, and as our population ages, it's more and more prevalent, and creates great misery for patients and families. We know that the memory disorder of Alzheimer's disease is one of the earliest features. In fact, we now believe that there are even pre-Alzheimer's indicators, and that's what a lot of the research has been focused on, trying to find a behavioral or a cognitive biomarker, if you will, or an indicator that the person is on the path to Alzheimer's disease. It's estimated that at the time that someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, they've already had brain changes going on for a decade or more. And one of the most prevalent ideas about the treatment of Alzheimer's is that if we have an effective medication, we need to use it very, very early, and hopefully before the person displays symptoms. So one of the things that we're doing in our research is trying to develop tests and indicators that can pick up very, very subtle changes.
And so you're looking for patients for a clinical trial?
Well, we do have a clinical trial ongoing now of a dietary intervention for Alzheimer's patients. We know that in Alzheimer's disease, the brain does not use glucose normally, doesn't use sugar in a normal way. And so we're doing some research that is looking right now at a high-fat diet, actually, a high-fat diet with very low carbohydrates to see if the fat metabolism, which generates ketone bodies that the brain can use for fuel, might be an alternative treatment or might help restore some memory functioning in Alzheimer's patients. So we are, in fact, looking for patients with mild cognitive impairment or very early Alzheimer's disease for a clinical trial.
So someone wants to take part?
If someone's interested in finding out more about the study, they can call our offices at Johns Hopkins. The number is 410-955-1647 and find out more about this trial.
410-955-1647. We will put that phone number on our midday page at WIPR.org. We've got quite a few people calling us. Let's talk to Helen in Owings Mills. Helen, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, hi. I'm interested in hearing if there's anything new about frontotemporal lobe dementia. My father died of it 6 years ago, and it definitely wreaked havoc with his memory. You know, he was a guy, he was a dentist. He was very verbal, quick-witted, and, you know, could tell you the names of any actors in any movie from the 40s. and repaired cars, repaired appliances around the house. And then when he was 76, suddenly developed this word retrieval problem. And within a few years, I mean, I knew the as what you would call the procedural memory was going, because he needed my help to mix up some epoxy to glue something back on, which is the kind of thing that actually he taught me to do a long time ago. And, you know, that's a really terrible disease, because unlike Alzheimer's, you know, after a while, they can't communicate. They can't remember any words. So I was wondering what you could comment about that disease.
Helen, thanks for the question.
Sure. It sounds like your dad was quite a guy. He sounds like a wonderful person. Frontotemporal dementia is in some ways similar to Alzheimer's disease, but Alzheimer's affects the temporal lobes and posterior part of the brain first, while frontotemporal dementia affects the frontal areas of the brain first. There are several different forms of frontotemporal dementia. One of the more common ones has a behavior change that occurs earliest. So the person might have very good memory and very good language skills, but they lose their social demeanor and their social skills and engage in all sorts of objectionable behavior. That can cause be really devastating for the patient and the family. And it tends to have an early onset. It sounds like your father had a different variety of frontotemporal dementia, which is called primary progressive aphasia, where they lose language skills as a prominent feature. One of the big research pushes in this area is to identify the proteins that are involved, the abnormal proteins that are laid down in the brain, and the genes that control those proteins. So there's a lot of research being done on the genetics of the frontotemporal dementias, as well as the genetics of Alzheimer's disease.
Peggy in Baltimore has emailed us with a different question about her father. She says, I remember almost nothing about my father, who died suddenly when I was 7 years old. Could that loss of memory be due to that traumatic event?
So, the old school psychological explanations of memory loss were that we forget things that are emotionally charged. And it's sort of the old psychodynamic or psychoanalytic theory, Freudian theory, that said that we repress things that are painful. One of the big problems with that theory is that it's very hard to either verify or to contradict. And it's very hard to do research on things, on processes that are unconscious. We do know that for the first 3 or 4 years of our lives, we have what we call infantile amnesia. And all adults have this. All adults have amnesia for the first few years of our lives. The memories simply don't exist. We don't have a mature enough nervous system to lay down strong, permanent, lasting, accurate memories. You lost your dad, unfortunately, when you were quite young. There was some time that you had that you might have had memories, and there might be things that could trigger those memories for when you were 5 or 6 or 7. So it is possible that those memories are in your memory store, but are inaccessible or unavailable at the moment. And there's often the case that things are stored in our memory. We have created memories. They're there, but they're difficult to retrieve. And one of the things that we know from psychological research is that there are various methods that we can use to help people retrieve information. And some memory disorders are particularly disorders of memory retrieval.
Because we've got so many callers, I'm not going to ask you what those techniques are, but maybe we should have another conversation about that. Susan is calling us from Baltimore. Susan, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. My question is, do you have any recommendations of nutritional supplements and or nutritional dietary approaches that can stave off memory problems?
Susan, thank you for the question.
This is a very commonly asked question about dietary ways to prevent memory loss or prevent Alzheimer's disease. And unfortunately, there are no vitamins or supplements that can do so. Probably the one that's used the most is ginkgo biloba. Ginkgo biloba is widely used to improve memory and to prevent the development of age-associated memory impairments, but the best clinical trials have shown repeatedly that it just doesn't work better than placebo. So in terms of eating a diet, we recommend a balanced diet, a heart-healthy diet, a diet that is in general low in saturated fats. Again, this is different from my clinical trial that we're doing, which is a very specific diet. But a heart-healthy diet is usually considered a brain-healthy diet.
We're almost out of time, but Phil is calling us from North Baltimore. Phil, can you make your comment quickly?
Good afternoon, Sheila and Doctor. Hello.
Hello.
I really think I must defy medical logic because I am 63 years old, and I have a number of health problems in recent years, but I still have an outstanding memory. One problem I have is I'm getting about 4 hours sleep a night, but I still keep track of thousands of events in history. And I know many events in my own life, both good and bad, that have happened going back to the age of 7. I remember the exact dates of my trips to Europe, all 8 trips, other things, and all the presidents in order I can name. I've memorized every World Series baseball champion since 1903, and many events about the Olympics, and many other things I don't have the time to explain here. But I wonder how it's possible for someone 63 years old, who does have some medical problems, including sleep problems, but still I have an outstanding memory.
Phil says he's known as the amazing memory man of Baltimore. Do you have an explanation?
Yes, there are a number of these folks out there who have what is called hyperamnesia or hyperthymesia. These are people who have essentially perfect autobiographical memories. The actress Mary Lou Henner from the TV show Taxi has written about this extensively and has appeared on television shows. And these are unusual people. They are quite rare. They're quite gifted in terms of their memory. Researchers have studied them using modern imaging techniques and find that they do have a slightly different neuroanatomy in critical areas. For example, a couple of recent studies have shown that the amygdala, that region right next to the hippocampus, is larger in size in these patients and has greater connectivity to other areas of the brain. So there might be some neuroanatomical basis for this incredible memory talent. And I'd be happy to meet with Phil and discuss it further.
Carolyn emailed us about hyperthymesia and sort of raised the question of whether it's not a problem to remember everything.
Well, many people have believed that we forget for a reason, and it makes sort of common sense. If you can think, if you remember every crossword that was ever said to you or every mean thing that your spouse ever did, it could really wreck your relationships. But in fact, people who have this condition tend to be very well adjusted emotionally. They're not people who are troubled souls or who have psychological disorders. They tend to be quite well adjusted.
Rebecca had called us from Western Maryland. I don't have time to put her on the air, but she asked, why do people who have had concussions lose memory?
Well, a concussion is defined by a temporary interruption in memory and consciousness. When you have a concussion, you have a blow to the head. You're shaking up the system. And so whatever neural circuits were firing get temporarily suppressed, and therefore memories are not being recorded.
There's so much more we wanted to talk about and more people who wanted to do it, but we are out of time. I really want to thank you, Dr. Jason Brandt, Professor of Neurology and Psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. This has been a fun hour. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
And again, people who want to take part in his clinical trial, the phone number is 410-955-1647. I want to thank our listeners for making this such an interesting hour. Tune in tomorrow. We'll have a conversation about Baltimore City's aging sewage system. More than 12 million gallons of untreated wastewater was released into a city stream last week, so I hope you'll be with us for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.